Welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Avi Killip. Ever wonder why we have to drink 4 cups of wine at the Seder? Dr. Jeremy Tabak explores the history and the symbolism of this idea and how it transforms from something more functional to the framing around the entire Seder night. Fittingly, there are at least 4 different ways to think about these cups. Let's listen.
Welcome, everyone. We're entering into this countdown to Pesach. And what I wanted to talk about today with all of you is the 4 cups of wine and why there are 4 cups of wine. So I'm going to offer essentially 5 different explanations for why that is. The first one is incredibly boring, and the others are much more interesting and meaningful. And one of them you may have heard before, or you're most likely to have heard of one of them before. And the others, for some reason, have fallen under the radar. So one of these cases, the 4 cups of wine, is one of these cases of where you have various different, traditions say different things, different midrashim say different things, but somehow we all only know one thing about it. We only know one of those traditions, and we don't know the rest of it. One of them became the most popular, and the others kind of fell away. This is definitely a case of that. We're going to talk about the Mishnah, where the 4 cups of wine are mentioned first. That's the first thing we're going to do. And then we're going to spend the rest of the time in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is the earlier of the 2 Talmuds. There's a Babylonian Talmud and a Talmud of Eretz Israel. Because in fact, the Babylonian Talmud, the one when you say the Talmud, you normally mean the Babylonian Talmud. And in the Babylonian Talmud, they actually never discuss exactly why there are 4 cups. We may end up talking a little bit about why that is. And it's actually only found in the Yerushalmi, the discussion of why there are 4 cups. And the commentators on the Bavli, the people who try to explain the Bavli, the Talmud Bavli, they actually just quote the Yerushalmi when they're explaining it. They just say, oh yeah, there's these explanations that are in the Yerushalmi for why there are 4 cups of wine, because the Bavli itself doesn't really offer one. So that's what we're going to do. So we're going to see how a very boring answer of why there are 4 cups of wine eventually became imbued with a deep meaning and what that could mean for our seders this year. So the first thing to see is we have the Mishnah. And this Mishnah is the first time we hear about 4 cups. And the Mishnah uses the 4 cups to sort of structure its whole discussion of the seder. So I've just given you little excerpts. You could see the whole chapter and various parts of this Mishnah. This chapter of Mishnah ended up in our Haggadah. The 4 cups are first mentioned in the very first line of the 10th chapter, the last chapter of Mishnah Pesachim about Pesach. It says, "Afilu ani shebi Yisrael lo yochal ad sheyaseiv." Someone who is poor, even they should eat reclining. That's just a way of saying it should be a fancy high-end meal, right? It shouldn't just be sitting and eating in haste. It should be reclining and relaxing and having a good time. And that's the origin of our practice of reclining at the Seder today when we eat specific foods or drink specific wine. And then, v'lo yifchatu lo me'arba akosot shel yayin. And also, you shouldn't reduce for this poor person less than 4 cups of wine. The minimum number of cups of wine they have to have is v'afilu minatam chui. Even if they have to basically find the money for this wine from tzedakah funds, from charity funds, or maybe they have to use money they would have otherwise used for food, and they still have to buy the wine. They still have to have 4 cups of wine. It's important to ensure everybody has 4 cups of wine. That's the first mention of the 4 cups. It doesn't explain why it's important to have 4 cups of wine. It just says it's important to have 4 cups of wine. So important that we have to ensure every member of our community, regardless of financial means, has those 4 cups. Okay, so then it uses these 4 cups to describe the various steps of the Seder. So you can see, mazgulo kos rishon, they mixed the first cup. So in those days, wine was always diluted. You didn't drink wine straight. So there's some amount of the wine and some amount of water, and you mix it together, and that's how you make your cup. So they would first get a first cup, and then they have an argument about mavarech al hayom, that's the blessing of kiddush, right? Mekadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim. Or whether Mavarech al Hayayin, which is the blessing for the wine, Borei Pri Hagafen, they debate which one comes first. We follow Beit Hillel, as we always, almost always do. And we say the Borei Pri HaGafen first, and then you say Mekadesh Yisrael Hazmanim second. So this cup is the Kiddush cup, right? It's the cup that comes in Kiddush, similar to the cup you would have in any other Shabbat or Yom Tov. It's just the first cup of wine that comes with Kiddush to sanctify the day. That's the first cup of wine. So first cup, Kiddush. Second cup of wine, Mazgulo Kos Sheini, Chein HaBein Sho'el, this is where the son asks in the second cup, Imdat Bavein Aviv Malamdo, and then they talk about the father teaches the son. So the way that the Mishnah talks about the Seder is like there's a father who runs the Seder, and then there's the family and the servants that are part of the household. So this is what we call the Magid, right? The cup that comes with Magid, which also for them was part of the meal as well. They would do the Magid during the meal. Today, most often we end up doing a Magid telling the story of the Haggadah. We normally do that before the meal, but for them, they did it simultaneously. So this is just the cup that comes with the meal. So this cup signifies the beginning of the meal and the main part of the Seder, which involves questions and answers and teaching and discussing the stories in various different ways. So that's the second cup. So the first cup is Kiddush. The second cup is the cup you drink during the meal. Right, and you would always drink cups of wine during the meal because it aids digestion. That's just part of what you do at any good meal. You would have cups of wine in the middle as you're going to help you digest the food. Okay, then you skip a little bit and you end up with Mazgulo Kos Shlishi, the third cup. Uvarech al Mazono. That's where you bless on the food. In other words, that's the cup for Birkat HaMazon. So some people today still have the custom of doing Birkat HaMazon with a glass of wine. Almost everybody does that on Seder night itself. But some people have the custom of doing that on Shabbat. Every Shabbat, doing the Birkat HaMazon on a glass of wine. And some people do, in theory, you could do it anytime. Anytime you want, you could do grace after meals and you could do it over a glass of wine. That was the original way Birkat HaMazon was done. So once again, we have the first cup is Kiddush. The second cup is during the meal. The third cup goes with the Birkat HaMazon at the end of the meal. So none of these three cups are specific to anything, really. That's what you would do on Shabbat. It's what you would do on Yom Tov. It's just three cups of wine you would normally have. At least three, by the way. Three is the minimum, right? You have to leave at least one for Kiddush, and then you have your appetizers course. Then you have one in the meal and have the main course, but you could have as many as you want during that time. And then you would have one with the Birkat HaMazon. There are practices, Judith, of only doing it with a certain number of people. But fundamentally, the original practice of Birkat HaMazon in the Mishnah is that you could just did it on a glass of wine. So what we've learned is actually three cups of the four cups of the Seder are completely normal and not interesting when it comes to the Seder. They're just the normal cups of wine you would drink at a normal fancy meal. Aha, but then we get the interesting one. Revi, the fourth cup, Gomer et Hahalel. Omer Alav Birkat Hashir. The fourth cup is where we finish Hallel. So the way the Seder is structured, right, we have two psalms of the six psalms of Hallel. We have two of them before the meal, and then we have the other four and some extra stuff after the meal. So this is talking about the second set of Hallel, when we finish Hallel. And you say Birkat Hashir, the blessing for doing Hallel, which in our Haggadah is Nishmat Kol Chai, and it runs through Yishtabach and Yehallelucha, those three liturgical pieces there, which is sort of all one liturgical piece. It's all liturgical, but it's all Birkat HaShir, the blessing of the song. And that is what the cup of wine is for. It's for Hallel and the blessing that comes with it. And in fact, right, Hallel is unique to Seder night. There's no other night in the year where you say Hallel. Otherwise, Hallel has to be said during the day. And Seder night is the only night of the whole year where you say Hallel. So the unique cup seems to come with Hallel. So why is there a specific cup that comes with Hallel? I might say two things about that. I think it is definitely possible that they thought Hallel always, even in shul, during the day, came with a cup of wine. That's definitely possible. There's no source that contradicts that suggestion. But there's also no source that says it explicitly. So that's my conjecture. But there is also a verse in Hallel itself which refers to a cup. Which we're going to see come up later on as we get through the next sources, for Kos Yeshuot Esa, I lift the cup of salvations. And I think that line, that verse talking about a cup, may have helped associate this Hallel with a cup of wine. So in other words, this is the boring answer to the question. Why are there four cups of wine at Seder night? That's not the right question. The question is, why are there four and not three? Because there would always be three, and on Seder night, there's four. And the answer is because the fourth comes with Hallel, for whatever reason. Okay? And in fact, the Mishnah comes along and actually just exactly clarifies this thing, which is that the other cups are normal, and the fourth cup is unique. When it says, Bein ha-kosot ha-ele, between these cups, which is the first three, if you want to drink, you can drink as much as you want. There's no minimum in those cups. You can drink just as many as you want during that time. But between the third cup and the fourth cup, you can't drink because you've already done Birkat HaMazon. You finished your meal. You can't just keep on drinking wine. So the fourth cup is the unique cup. The other cups are all part of your normal meal, and you would just be able to drink through as much as you want during that time. The fourth cup comes along with Hallel and is this unique aspect of Seder night. And therefore, you can't drink after you finish the meal. This is, by the way, still true for halakha today, that you shouldn't drink any more wine after the third cup, but you can drink as much wine as you want before that third cup. But if you want to drink water, you can certainly drink water. That is also clear. But wine is a no-go. Okay, so that's the boring answer. It's just normal meal customs and the addition of Hallel, which also, by the way, plays into a general tension that runs through the practice of Seder night, which is, in what Manish Tanah Halal Azeh, we think of the night as very different from other nights, but in many ways, we want it to be as similar to other fancy meals as possible. There's a tension between Seder night being unique and Seder night just being what you recognize as a fancy meal, which we already saw above when the Mishnah makes clear that everyone, including poor people who wouldn't normally recline as part of their meals, everyone needs to go to the high-end level and recline. And the four cups seem to be in the same camp, basically. In other words, if I were like translating this sort of idiomatically for today, I might say something like, everyone has to get a good bottle of fancy wine for your Seder. And that might be like sort of the equivalent. It's like the point is the Seder needs to be a high-end meal. And that's what this the four cups are trying to get to. It should be high-end. It should have the normal cups of the meal and then a fourth cup at the end to sort of, emphasize the estate, the extent to which we're free and can celebrate the way free people do. You can also see that like they don't spend time in the Mishnah trying to work out ritual requirements for the cups, because they don't have a sense of you have to drink four. Four is like the required obligation in and of itself. It's like an obligation to have four cups of wine on the Seder. They don't think of it like that. They just think, well, you have your three normal cups and an additional fourth. It's not like some kind of additional obligation to have four cups. So what we're going to explore now is going to look at the passage in the Yerushalmi. And the first thing we're going to see is that the Yerushalmi starts talking about the ritual requirements of the cups and treats the four cups as its own independent obligation. And already, like the Yerushalmi no longer understands the context of the Mishnah that three cups is normal and the fourth cup is surprising, right? There was actually a major change in dining customs in the Roman Empire between the 3rd century and the 4th century. And the Mishnah is from the 3rd century and the Yerushalmi is from the 4th century. So the Yerushalmi already has lost some of the context that made the Mishnah make sense. And it becomes sort of its own legalistic, formalistic way of thinking about the cup. So let's just dive in a little bit on this section to see how it's become sort of its own ritual obligation. And then we're going to spend time with the midrashic sort of meaning making that the Yerushalmi does, where it tries to tell us what the cups are for and what they symbolize. Kamahu shiran shalakosat. How much do you have to drink? How much is each cup? And there's an answer. I don't know how much that is, but it's a quart and a revia, a quarter of a quart. I don't know how much that is at all. I don't know what the Roman quart is, but whatever. There's an answer. Can you drink all of them at once? This question doesn't make any sense in the framework of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is just concerned that you have your normal cups of wine and an additional one for Hallel. And now we're saying, okay, I understand you have to do four cups, but can I drink them all in one go? Can I like sit down at the Seder and just drink four cups straight up right now, one after the other? And did I fulfill my obligation? And it turns out the answer is yes. And the reason the answer is yes, according to the Yerushalmi, is that you can actually, in the Seder, you're supposed to split up Hallel, as we discussed. You're supposed to have a Hallel, the first two Psalms at the beginning, and then the last four Psalms at the end. But nonetheless, if you did Hallel all together in Shul, which is what this Rabbi Yochanan tradition is talking about, if you went to Shul and you heard the whole of Hallel all at once, six Psalms together, then you actually fulfilled your obligation for Hallel. And there's not required to split Hallel up into two parts. You could do it all together. So the analogy is, just as the way it's not required for Hallel to do it split up, it's also not required for the four cups to be split up. You could, at least according to your Yerushalmi. I don't want to say this is a halakha for you to do it your seders today, but at least according to your Yerushalmi, you could just sit there, drink one cup after another, one, two, three, four, and then you're done. And similarly, ma'u l'shotam mefusakin, it's not totally obvious what this question is, but it seems like the point is, maybe I could, drink the required measurement for each cup, but split over multiple cups. And the answer is yes, you can, because the goal is not to get drunk on Seder night. And if you drink smaller amounts over a longer period of time, you're less likely to get drunk. We're in the space between having enough wine to have a good time and not having too much wine that you lose control. We have to be in the middle there. And so anything that pushes you towards the side of not getting drunk is good. So again, they say, yes, you can have the smaller measures of wine that add up to the required amount of wine. Ma'ulat seit b'yayin shel shvi'it. Another question, what happens if the wine doesn't belong to you? It's actually sabbatical wine and you don't own it and you're not allowed to drink it. What happens then? Did you fulfill your obligation in the four cups? The answer is yes. Yes, you did. Can you fulfill your obligation with spiced wine? This is a Latin word, conditium, I think, which is a spiced wine. And the answer is yes, you can. Can you fulfill your obligation with wine that is very diluted, with a lot of water? And the answer is yes, you can. Doesn't matter. It could be raw. It could be diluted. Unmixed, undiluted. It could be diluted. As long as it basically looks and tastes like wine, you're fine. Then Rabbi Yirmi also has a similar thing where he says, mitzvah latzeit b'yayin adom. Ideally, you should fulfill your Seder night obligations with red wine. This is still a halachic preference, that if you can do red wine at the Seder, you should, but it's not a big deal. You're totally fine with other wine, but red wine is still the preference. And he brings a verse about red wine from Proverbs to sort of prove his point. And then it says, "Mahu latzeit b'yayin mevushal." Can you do cooked wine as well? And the answer is yes. So there's a few interesting things you could pull out of here. You know, there's a lot of they ask all of these questions sort of defining the limits of what's acceptable, and they basically find that everything is acceptable, right? Almost everything is fine. So the ritual limits are low, right? The ritual limits are not very high. They're not the ritual requirements are not high for the four cups of wine. But nonetheless, their assumption that there are ritual requirements already tells you how far we have moved from the Mishnah's framework, where it's just like, oh, drink the wine that you would normally drink, plus one. And they didn't have to really explain anything else because they sort of you understood there was a whole context of dining customs behind it. How do they get to grape juice that does not taste like wine at all? Well, it doesn't taste like wine, but it still is made of grapes. So I think you're kind of fine there. Also, don't just use the Yerushalmi for your halakha. There's been a lot of development since the Yerushalmi for halakha. And I can tell you what the Yerushalmi says, but I'm not a rabbi. I can't necessarily tell you what the halakha is. I'll tell you some things I know, but don't rely on me. Rely on your rabbi instead. Minayin la'arva kosot. Where do the four cups come from? Okay, and the first answer is the answer that many people have heard before. Rabbi Yochanan b'shem Rabbi Benaya, keneged arba geulot. It's corresponding, the four cups correspond to the four redemptions. And this is what he says, L'chein emor l'bnei Yisrael, ani Adonai v'otziti etchem, blah, blah, blah. They recite the passage, v'lakachti etchem l'am, v'gomer, the whole passage, they recite the passage here. And they clarify the Midrash. There are four verbs. V'otziti, I'll bring you out. V'itzalti, I will save you. V'ga'alti, I will redeem you. V'lakachti, I will take you. Okay, so this passage I put on the bottom here, so you can see it here. So this is a fairly intuitive place to go, you know. This is what God said to the children of Israel. I'll bring you out from the burdens of Egypt. I'll save you from their slavery. I'll redeem you with an outstretched hands and with signs and wonders. And I'll take you to be my people. and I will be your God. And you'll know that I am God who brought you out from the burdens of Egypt. This is a fairly intuitive place to go, right? It's talking about the Exodus. And there are four verbs that they've highlighted here, about seiti, v'itzalti, v'ga'alti, and v'lakachti, these four verbs. And that's sort of maps onto the four cups. In other words, like, you know, the way this seder sort of operates is you're drinking with each cup, you're sort of getting further along the way to redemption, right? You're the first cup, you have been brought out from the labors of Egypt. The second cup, you've been saved from their slavery. The third cup, you've been saved with an outstretched hand. And the fourth cup, you've been taken to be God's people. So it's sort of this unfolding Exodus, right? We get to basically live out the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim through the four cups by acting out this narrative through the four verbs. Some of you may also know that the passage does not end with the verb v'lakachti, but there is a fifth verb in the same form in the next verse. V'heveti etchem el ha'aretz, and I will bring you to the land asher nasati et yadi latet ota, that I gave it l'Abraham Yitzchak Yaakov, to your ancestors Abraham Yitzchak Yaakov. So there is a fifth verb, right? V'heveti, I bring you to the land of Israel. So what happened to that verb? Why did we just skip that one? So there's a couple of interesting things to say about that. The first thing is, right, many people today associate, in fact, we do have a fifth cup. Right, what's the fifth cup? A cup that we pour and do not drink is the cup for Elijah, the Kos Eliyahu. So in fact, we do have a fifth cup. So some people associate that fifth cup with this fifth verb, which is to say, God will bring us to the land of Israel, and Eliyahu sort of makes that into a messianic aspiration, right? The presence of Eliyahu there, and the fact that it's his cup makes it into like a final aspiration. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is some years ago in the Heart of Torah, Rav Shai, one of our teachers at Hadar, he wrote an essay about how the Seder and the Torah both are journeys with the ending lopped off. The ending is just missing. Like the whole Torah, you spend getting excited to come back to the land of Israel, and then you never get back in. It actually just, we just go back to the beginning and do the whole thing all over again. And the Seder is exactly the same. The whole Seder is sort of geared up to be excited about being freed from Egypt and about to go back into the land. And then we never talk about going back into the land. So the omission of the Be'er Beiti here could be sort of an intentional part of the way we tell the story, which is a story without an ending. That's part of what the Seder is here too. There's the story, but there's no actual conclusion to that story. We're still in the story. Great, so that's this Seder. Sort of fairly intuitive with stepping through, as the Seder progresses, we're sort of going through the story of the Exodus. And there's this sort of the shadow of the fifth cup, the fifth verb, which some people put on the Kos Eliyahu and use that to represent the final redemption to go to Israel. So that's the one you're most likely to have heard before. But there are three others. So the next one is Rabbi Shua ben Levi. He says that the four cups of the Seder correspond to the four cups of Pharaoh. And he cites the four verses here, four instances of the word cup, and we'll see the passage in a second. Bekos paro biadi, ve'eshkat otam el kos paro, ve'etenet ha-kos al yad paro, ve'natat ha-kos paro biado. The context here is Yosef is talking to someone in prison who had a dream. This is the Star Hamashkim of Pharaoh. His sort of butler or his cupbearer. And he had a dream where he was bringing cups to Pharaoh, right? He was in jail because he displeased Pharaoh somehow. We never really find out why. And so he was thrown into jail. And then he has this dream where he brings cups to Pharaoh. And Yosef is luckily able to interpret dreams and tells him, don't worry, this is a great thing for your dream. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will pardon you and restore you to your post. You will place the cup, Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as you used to do when you were his cupbearer. The strength of this interpretation, right? The weakness of the previous interpretation was, of the four verbs, is that there's nothing in those verbs about cups, right? In theory, we could have instantiated four verbs, the four verbs of redemption, in four matzahs, right? Four matzahs would have been the same symbolism. right? Which is all you need is four for the verbs. The strength of this one is it's about cups, right? It's actually four instances of the word kos, or cup. Then the question is, what is this Seder trying to tell us? And I think there's kind of two different ways I could think of running the way this Seder is symbolically set up. The first way to think about this is, well, now we are free. We're not slaves to Pharaoh anymore. In some ways, we are now Pharaoh, right? We're able to be Pharaoh. And just like Pharaoh had this luxurious time with four cups of wine, so too we, who are now free from Pharaoh, can have those four cups of wine. So in that way, it's sort of like the turning of the tables. We are free, and the Egyptians are destroyed. We get the four cups that Pharaoh used to have, right? So in some ways, we sort of have become, we've taken the place of Pharaoh in our freedom. So that's one way I think you could think about this Seder. But another way I think you could think about it is, you know, what happened as a result of this dream? Well, Yosef says, okay, I told you a good dream, but just like pay me back. When you get to Pharaoh, tell him that I'm here in prison. Just remind him that I'm here so that maybe he'll bring me out. In other words, this dream was the origin of Yosef's redemption from prison, of his being saved from prison. So there's another way, which, by the way, then kicks off the entire Exodus narrative. He becomes the viceroy, he brings his family down to Egypt, then they get enslaved, etc. It actually is the origin of the whole narrative. So in that way, you could say that this Seder is maybe a Seder that's involved in about personal redemptions. You know, one thing that we, many people, especially Chassidim, like to think about is the way in which we sort of are always leaving our personal Egypt and moving to personal redemption. And this kind of holds that story where we're, in that way, we're like Yosef, you know, in the prison awaiting our redemption through these four cups. Although cup is mentioned four times, they're all referring to the same cup. Yes, that is true. What are you going to do? It's never going to be perfect. I mean, that's also what we do also, which is that, I don't know, we use the same cup. I guess it's different wine in each cup, but it's probably not going to use four different glasses. So yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's so fatal. But we'll see other examples of four different cups. Those are the next two examples. But yes, it's true. They're all the same cup. But nonetheless, the four cups mentioned, so mention all four instances of the word cup mentioned in the context of Pharaoh is just very evocative of the whole reversal of the Exodus experience, right? In some ways, that's the whole point of the Exodus narrative, is that, yes, it's true, people can be beaten down and downtrodden and enslaved, but sometimes they go free. And that's the lesson of the Exodus, is like, you don't know what's going to happen. The whole world order could be overturned at any moment. And, you know, Egypt is the superpower of its day. And was just brought to its knees by the plagues. So yeah, that's part of the narrative here. Is like, you know, we don't know you don't know what the world order is going to look like tomorrow. Great. So this is the second interpretation. So either it's like, you know, we are free, and now we can be as free as Pharaoh was in those days, or there's some sense of sort of individual redemption, just like we are Yosef in the pit, getting out through the four cups, right? Every cup sort of brings us closer to our, right? The first one is sort of every cup increases our revel as a free Pharaoh. And the second version is sort of every cup brings us closer to redemption from the prison. So that's the second interpretation. Then we get a third from Rabbi Levi. And he says, it is corresponding to the four kingdoms. So he doesn't bring any specific proof texts because the four kingdoms is just a well-known trope that starts first in the book of Daniel in the Tanakh. The four kingdoms are, everyone agrees that there are four kingdoms. People do a bit disagree as to which those four kingdoms are, as chiefly whether the last kingdom is Rome or Greece. But nonetheless, the basic principle of the four kingdoms is that the Jews will be slaves to four kingdoms in succession. And after the last kingdom, it'll be Mashiach, right? It'll be the Olam Haba, it'll be the next world. There won't be any more enslavement of the Jews anymore. It'll be over. So it seems like what Rabbi Levi is imagining, instead of, right, the first version was was anchored in the Exodus, right? The four verbs of redemption of God bringing us out of Egypt. And that's the story we're reenacting. The second one was reenacting maybe a more personal story about how we are free. And or how we might be redeemed This story is a sort of a national, grand historical narrative, which is bigger than the Exodus narrative, which is to say, we're not reenacting a specific Exodus happening. We are reenacting what we hope will be the final redemption of the whole world, right? And the final end of suffering. And in that way, it's like, you know, you could imagine it this way. Every cup you drink is like, there goes another kingdom, right? You drink one cup, it's like, oh, there goes Babylon. You drink another cup, oh, there goes Persia. It's like, every kingdom sort of gets wiped away. And we're still here, and we're anticipating the final redemption where these kingdoms won't have any sway over us anymore. And that's the story of this Seder. You know, like one of the things in the Seder, there's like in Pesach in general, there's a tension between sort of the more particularist aspects of Pesach, of like, this is a story of our freedom, versus the more universalistic aspects of like, this is a story of freedom in general, of everyone's freedom. And there's tension that runs through all the sources about this. Like, for example, you can see Maimonides, when he talks about what you're supposed to do the Seder, one of the things that he says you're supposed to do is if you have a servant right there, you're supposed to say something like, we are free, unlike this slave. This guy is still enslaved, but we are free, right? That's a very particularist narrative, which is that the story of Pesach is about our freedom. And yeah, that sometimes freedom comes at the cost for other people, but not fundamentally, we're celebrating our freedom. We're not celebrating other people's freedom. This Rabbi Levi's story comes along and says, no, this is actually a bigger story. This is not just a specific freedom that happened in the time of the Exodus. This is a grander freedom that we're still awaiting to come. Also, another tension in the Seder, by the way, that this helps sort of tease out, is the tension of whether we are free now or whether we will be free in the future. There's another tension that runs through the Seder. So, for example, Halach Ma'anya says, this year we are slaves, next year we'll be free, which is kind of a bizarre thing to say for a holiday that is celebrating the fact that we're already free. Right, but part of what that's saying is, even though we're free in some ways, there's always ways in which we're not free, and there are ways we could be more free in the future. This sense of the four kingdoms is like this grand global story, and also a story that hasn't finished yet. Right, we're still, whoever talks about the four kingdoms, we're always in the midst of that last kingdom, whatever that kingdom is. Maybe it's America, I don't know. But we're in the midst of that fourth kingdom, and we're waiting for that kingdom to fall so that the final redemption can come. What were the kingdoms? So yes, so the first one is normally Babylon, the second one is normally Persia, the third one is normally Greece, and the fourth one is normally Rome. But like I said, it depends on which time you live in, which is precisely the four you have. So the original ones in Daniel, it can't be Rome because he predates the Roman conquest of Eretz Israel. So the fourth kingdom is Greece. I don't know what the other ones are. Maybe one of them is the Assyrians. But the point is, everyone agrees there are four kingdoms, but not everybody agrees on what those four kingdoms are. Okay, so that's Rabbi Levi's story, the Rabbi Levi Seder. So we've seen, so there's one which is anchored in the Exodus and the historical freedom of our people. There's one which is sort of anchored in a more individualized redemption or individualized expressions of freedom. And there's this one which is a more sort of global redemption that we're still waiting to come. And picking up on this sort of anticipatory theme, we actually have the majority of it. So by the pure rules of how Jewish texts decide things, we would think that you should follow the majority opinion. And it's funny that the majority opinion, though we'll see, maybe it makes sense. It's interesting that the majority opinion did not become the accepted opinion, but actually the first opinion about the four verbs became the accepted opinion. So the majority opinion, the rabbis say, it is corresponding to the four cups of punishment that God will bring the nations of the world. And there's actually, they kind of cheated. They get sort of two explanations for the price of one, because up here it's against the four punishments, but then down here they continue and they say, and it's also corresponding to the four cups of nechamot, of punishment, of comfort that will be given to Israel in the future. And they bring some verses. So that this, by the to Mai, who said that there was a cup is mentioned four times, they're all the same cup. So here now we have a situation of four different cups, it seems. Kikor Amar Denayel Israel, Eli Kachet Kos Hayayin Hachema, the cup of wine of wrath, right? This sort of very dangerous cup. Kos Zahav Bavel Biyad Adonai, this is actually a place I can fix it right now while I'm here. Again, the golden cup of Bavel is now, it belongs to God, doesn't belong to Bavel anymore, and now it's in the hand of God. Ki kos b'yad Adonai, there's a cup in God's hand, yim taro v'sha'im pachim, eish v'gofrit, ruach salachot, menat kosam. And again, this, so menat kosam, we'll come back to that, but the point is the kos in the kosam. But all of these are situations where God will sort of bring down wrath on the nations in the future, and it uses the language of kos. Now, menat kosam, in its literal, but in its basic sense, in the contextual meaning of that verse, probably means something more like their portion, but it still costs enough for us to use it for this midrash. And then we have this explanation of sort of what is this? What do you mean a bad cup? A cup of wine that's like bad? What does that even mean? What experience is that related to? And so Rabbi Aben gives a description of that experience. Which makes sense, I assume, if you've been to a bathhouse. Me, I've never been to a bathhouse, so I couldn't tell you if it actually makes sense. But he says that it's like it's the drinking those kind of cups are as bad as drinking these cups after the bathhouse. After you come out of the bathhouse, there's some experience of you've gone into this hot sort of sauna-like environment, and you leave, and then you're drinking wine, and it just makes you feel terrible. I don't know if anybody here has had that experience. I certainly have not, but he's giving you sort of a story, a metaphor of how to think about what a cup of wrath and a cup of punishment might be. And then we also get on the flip side, the cups of comfort, right? So again, we have kos, meaning really portion, not cup. Adonai manat chelki v'kosi, but it's good enough, my cup. And then we get a good one from a psalm we sing fairly often, Adonai ru'i lo echsar, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Dishanta v'shemen roshi kosi reveya, my cup is overflowing. And then we get the last one, kos yeshua tasa, which we've already mentioned, right? The verse that's in Hallel itself. What's the problem? There are only three verses. We didn't find a fourth verse, right? We only have three cups, not four. So where's the fourth cup? Well, don't worry. Yeshuot is plural. Right, so kos yeshuot is a plural cup, so that's two cups. So even though we've got three verses, we actually get to four cups because kos yeshuot is really two cups. Okay, so that sort of brings us to the fully understand the Rabbanan's opinion here, right? So there's the four cups of punishment that God will bring to our enemies in the future, and there's the four cups of comfort that God will bring to us. And now this is obviously an uncomfortable image. This idea of punishment for them and comfort, vindication for us. And it only gets more uncomfortable every day in the current situation. And so there's a lot to be said about this image. That I would say just a couple of quick things. The first thing is it's important to remember that, Jews as an oppressed minority has been the majority experience of Jewish life throughout time. And such a experience of, I wish that we would be vindicated and other people would be punished, is understandable in that circumstance, even if you don't want to defend it necessarily. It makes sense. And the other thing that I would say is, like, it's not like this theme is not found in our Haggadah, in our Seder, right? There's actually a section, Shvoch HaMatacha, which many people don't say, which is all about God pouring wrath onto the nations. And that's part of that. You can't deny that this is part of the sort of tapestry of ideas and values that enters into the Haggadah, into the Arsadia experience. Yeah, so there's something. So even if what I'm saying is, even if we're uncomfortable with the experience of thinking about the Seder as like bringing us to the final vindication where we're proven right and everyone else will be punished, I don't think you can dismiss this either as something just too uncomfortable to think about. It is part of the Jewish experience. It's part of the Seder experience. And it's something that we need to wrestle with at our Seders, even if we don't agree. But yeah, so that's this sort of, again, it's sort of this broader eschatological view of what the Seder is trying to do, which is like, each cup we're imagining is like, finally, we're getting our vindication and everyone else is getting their comeuppance. It sort of gets to serve double duty. Yeah, so those are the four main interpretations here from the Yerushalmi. So we have the first one, which is about the four verbs of the Exodus, very sort of centered in the Exodus narrative, the historical national redemption from Egypt. There's the four cups of Pharaoh, which is the sort of a more personal story of redemption from a future redemption from prison or current freedom, the fact that we're Pharaoh and not slaves anymore. There's the version of the Four Kingdoms, which is sort of a grander eschatological narrative of the final redemption. And then there's the language of the four cups of punishment and the four cups of reward, this sort of final vindication of the Jewish life, of Jewish life and Jewish experience. So those are four very different ways of thinking about the Seder. I've tried to lay out for you the way in which the themes that come through these sources are actually woven into the Seder as it is, even now. So this follows up immediately from where this ended, where it starts talking about cooked wine, yayin mevushal, and it's actually related to so many of the themes that we've already spoken about. It sort of plays it out in sort of narrative form. And that was Rabbi Yonah who said that. Rabbi Yonah said you can fulfill your obligation of the four cups with cooked wine. Then it says Rabbi Yonah Gadate, he actually is just consistent in his opinion. Rabbi Yonah Shati Arbati Kasai, he drank the four cups of wine of that night, of the night of Pesach. But Chazi Greshe Ad Atzeret, and his head hurt until Atzeret. Now Atzeret, you might think is Shmini Atzeret, but in rabbinic literature, Atzeret means Shavuot. So it's not as long as Shmini Atzeret, but still it's 7 weeks. So in other words, he drinks cooked wine, and his punishment for doing so is he has a headache until for 7 weeks afterwards. Okay? So this is an interesting critique already of the idea of the four cups, which is to say, we started off by saying we have to do four cups. But one experience many of us have had at Seder is like, four cups is a lot of wine. And this is reflecting exactly on that. Right, and red wine is even more prone to cause migraines. Exactly right. I don't know about cooked wine. I don't know if you've had so much cooked wine. So already we're sort of problematizing the idea of the four cups. Like, yes, we have to do four cups, but actually there's like some real downside from doing so, especially if you do it in this, apparently this wine mevushal. It seems to be the context. So it doesn't say mevushal in the tradition of Rabbi Yonah, but that seems to be the context for it. Alternatively, right, the other way you could read it is, actually Rabbi Yonah prefers to use yayin mevushal because then he doesn't have a headache until Shavuot. If he just drinks normal wine, he has a headache until Shavuot. That's the other way. And then we have another story of a similar thing happening. Rabbi Yehuda bar Rabbi Eli shat arbati kosoy d'leile pischa. He also did the same thing. He drank the four cups you're supposed to drink on Pesach. V'chazi greshe ad chaga, and his head hurt until the chag, which is Sukkot. Right. So not only did his head didn't just hurt until Shavuot, he had a headache until Sukkot, 6 months later or whatever it is, something like that. But chamti chada matrona apoy nehirin. A Roman noblewoman, a matron, a matrona, saw that his face was shining, literally. And presumably, she's noticing that his face was red from all the wine. Amrale, and she says to him, Saba, Saba. Right, it's clearly a sort of derogatory. Old man, old man. Chada min tlat milan idbach. You've done one of these three things. Or shati chamarat. You've either drunk too much wine, or malve beribidat, or you have lend it on interest, which is forbidden, or megadel chazirimat, or you have raised pigs in Eretz Israel, which is also forbidden. In other words, they're saying the only reason you could be so happy is if you're drunk or you did something illegal. Right? The fact that your face is shining right now, it just means you must have done something wrong. Rabbi Yehuda does not have a glowing response to this woman's attacks. Amarla, he says to her, Tepach rucha dehi itata. Curse this woman. Hadam and Ilin Slati Milaya lately. I have done none of these three things. Ella Ulpanishkiachli, but actually I've just found an amazing Torah. I found like an amazing piece of Torah, new learning. Dichtiv Chokhmat Adam Ta'ir Panav, a verse from Ecclesiastes that the wisdom of a person lights their face. So my face is not shining because I did something illegal or because I drank too much wine, but actually it's because I learned an amazing Torah. That's why my face is shining. So now you could read into sort of his motivations, because in fact we know from the opening of the story that he did in fact drink too much wine, right? So then it calls into question of whether when he responds to the Matrona, is he lying when he says, I didn't do any of these things, but in fact he did do one of those things, he drank too much wine. Or maybe he's just sort of giving the Torah learning as an excuse. Or it could be that he actually is just like learned some Torah recently, and his face is shining because of that, not because of that. And we have a third version of this story. Rabbi Abahu Atah L'Tveria. So Rabbi Abahu came to Tveria. He lived in Caesarea, further south. He came up north to the Galilee to Tveria, which is the place of Rabbi Yochanan. Chamune Talmidoi de Rabbi Yochanan Apoi Nahirin. And the students of Rabbi Yochanan, who lived in Tiberias, saw that his face was shining. Amrun Kubi Rabbi Yochanan. They said to Rabbi Yochanan, Eshkach Rabbi Abahu Sima. Looks like Rabbi Abahu's found a treasure. He's so happy. He must have found something amazing. Amarlon Lama. So Rabbi Yochanan says, why? How do you know this? Amarle, they say to him, Apoi Nahirin. His face is shining. Amarlon Dilma Oraita Chadat Hashemah. But then Rabbi Yochanan's response is, well, maybe he learned some great new Torah. Salik Lagavi, he went to speak to Rabbi Yochanan. Amarle, Ma Or Yechadat Hashmat, what's the great Torah? What's the great new Torah that you've learned? Amarle, Rabbi Baha responds, V'tosefta Atikta. Not clear what that means, but some amazing thing where he just come across some ancient work. And he's so excited about having learned it that his face is shining. Bakara Aloy. Chokhmat Adam Ta'ir Panam, that the wisdom of a person lights up their face. So what's going on in this passage? And what they're doing here in the end of the sugya? So I've already laid out how it could be sort of problematizing the idea of the four cups, which is in tension with the idea that you shouldn't get drunk, right? There's some tension, some line you have to go through the middle of for Pesach in order to be free, in order to show that you're free, and also not show that you don't have any inhibitions. So that's certainly one piece of it. But that story sort of unfolds from the drinking of the four cups to actually the face shining because of Torah and learning Torah as a cause of happiness. And I guess part of why I like to teach this part of the end is because it's quite humorous. It's a bit of a funny series of stories, especially like Rabbi Yehuda's response to the Matrona and their interaction. But also part of it is like, I don't know, you know, I would wish for all of us to have our faces shining from the end of Pesach until Shavuot or beyond, you know, if that's what we could do because of what we have experienced and learned through that Seder, and then come out the other side with a shining face. That would be, I think that's the ideal here. You know, there's something long lasting about the Seder, not just the four cups. But the meaning that we imbue them with and the framework that it gives us for thinking about our narrative and how that narrative fits in with the grand narrative of the world and of the Jewish people. I wish all of you shining faces, as you say, Deborah, without the headache and without the defensiveness from a lovely Seder.
Our producers for this episode are Sam Greenberg and Jeremy Tabak. Thank you to Nadav Remez for editing this episode. I'm your host, Rabbi Avi Killip. It's been a pleasure to learn with you.